Hi everyone. As we near towards the end of the year, I wanted to let you know that registrations are still open for the January intake of my 12-week transformation program. Stepping Out from Behind the Smile is an immersive container that guides you through my holistic transformation model, helping you to step off the hamster wheel and start living a life you love. Whether you're looking to address your relationship with food, alcohol, money, or relationships, this program is designed to give you the tools to create a meaningful life on purpose. If you'd like to know more, you can reach out through my website, ashbutters.com, or DM me the word smile on Instagram. Let this be your sign to say yes to the life you deserve and start 2024 the way you want to live it. Just a note to let you know, this episode contains topics that some may find triggering. If you need support, please head to the show notes where you can find a range of mental health support contacts for both Australia and worldwide. Welcome to Behind the Smile with Ash Butters, a podcast designed to reveal the truth behind the masks we wear. Together, we look to demystify the human mind and its behaviours in relation to mental health, trauma, and addiction. My name's Ash, and I'll be your host as we uncover the real stories of people's pain and the steps they've taken to live a life of freedom in recovery. From sobriety to spirituality, join me each week as we uncover the reasons why people seek recovery and how their lives have changed by living one day at a time.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Behind the Smile. Today's guest is New York Times best-selling author, prison reform advocate, and mother of four, Lara Love Harden. Lara's recently released memoir, The Many Lives of Mama Love, recounts her slide from soccer mum to opioid addict to jailhouse shot caller, and her unlikely comeback to becoming a highly successful ghostwriter and published author. I had the pleasure of reading this memoir, and I have to say, I honestly could not put it down. The story around Lara's fall from grace and the reality of life in prison was detailed in such a way that I had never heard before. Lara's journey from shame to redemption is now inspiring others as she works to help previously incarcerated women rebuild their lives. I've really been looking forward to this conversation for quite some time now. So without any further delay, I'd love to welcome Lara onto the show. Lara, welcome to Behind the Smile. How are you today?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. I was sharing with you before we started recording that I was lucky enough to receive an early copy of your memoir. I devoured it while I was on holiday in Bali, and I have just been so excited to talk to you. So once again, thank you so much. Lara, I'd love to kick it off by asking you a couple of questions to allow our audience to get to know you a little bit better. So can we start off with you sharing, where do you live? What does an average day look like? And what do you do for fun?
Awesome. Well, I live in La Selva Beach, California, which is part of Santa Cruz County. I grew up in Massachusetts, but I've lived here for many decades and raised my family here. An average day, well, my days haven't been average since the book released because I've been traveling a lot. I've had to put on makeup and clothing and do my hair, which is not a normal day for me. I work as a literary agent. So my day is spent reading, talking to authors. I have five dogs, so there's a lot of dogs in my life and animals. I have chickens and ducks and cats. And so an average day is really just working. I've recently started playing pickleball, so that's a new little addiction I'm developing right now, a healthy one.
What's pickleball?
Oh, pickleball is like if tennis and ping pong had a baby, that would be pickleball. I don't know how else to explain it. I got it. Okay, yeah.
So yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
It's super fun. So I do that for fun now, and I do improv comedy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I do that every week. And I talk about that a little bit in the book, but so I do that for fun and just spend time with my family. My youngest just went off to college a few days ago,
I saw that on Instagram. Congratulations. Thank you. That must have been such a big moment. What came up for you emotionally?
You know what? Mostly I was really proud. Mm. Like proud of him and also like really proud of myself, which I don't ever like take time to feel or do. And, you know, over the last probably 14 years, it's been go, go, go and like prove and work. And so I never, my new practice is kind of to take a moment and like receive the goodness, like appreciate what's happening and celebrate and be proud of myself. And that's like a new muscle for me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so important, isn't it? I think we can be so focused sometimes on achieving the goal that when we get there, we forget to just sit in it and to relish the achievement. And then all of a sudden, I know for me anyway, it's like, okay, well, then what's next? And when we're constantly chasing, then we never really get that moment of just that contentedness. So that's beautiful. What a gorgeous message to share. Lara, I've asked you to bring in a photo today. Now, this is a photo from a time in your life where you are hiding behind a smile. So you were presenting one version of yourself to the outside world, but the reality was you were really struggling on the inside. Could you please describe for our listeners, what am I looking at when I'm looking at this photo? And what was actually going on for you at that time in your life?
So this photo, I have very few photos from this time in my life. After about 6 years clean and sober, just kind of on my own, I had relapsed and I was keeping a secret. My opiate addiction had progressed from pain medication to heroin. I had lost a lot of weight and I was making up all kinds of lies. I said I read The Secret and I manifested myself skinny. Like that was my brilliant lie, as we do, no one knows what's going on. And I was really invested in playing the role of the perfect cul-de-sac mom. I had my four children and two stepchildren at the time. I had six children in private school. I was desperately just trying to keep it together. And I was actually on a play date with another mom and her daughter, who's about the same age as my son, Caden. Caden's between 3 and 4 here. So that was in that last probably 6 months before the book starts, actually. And I was out of control and desperately trying to pretend everything was okay. And I kept thinking, I'll fix it tomorrow. And when I look at this picture, I remember, you know, I never had the language to ask for help. It doesn't come naturally or easy for me, or to admit that I don't have it all together and I can't handle things. And I remember thinking, knowing I needed help, knowing right from wrong in my head and like how I wanted to live my life. And I remember thinking, I can't tell anyone what's going on because there's no way I could spend 30 days away from my children.
You hear that so often, don't you?
Yeah. And then, you know, I ended up spending much, much longer away from them because I couldn't imagine that 30 days. It gets me all emotional still. It's been a while, but.
Yeah, I imagine it does. And at that time in your life, just thinking that whole idea of I'll get it sorted tomorrow, I think is something that anybody who's experienced addiction can relate to. It's like, but the problem is tomorrow never comes.
Right.
And it's just that hamster wheel cycle that we get trapped on. Your inability to ask for help, to reach out, was that something that developed as a result of your experiences through childhood?
Definitely. I was very much alone a lot of my childhood, so very independent. I grew up with a family that is a sort of riddled with addiction and alcoholism, and at a time when no one talked about it, right? Mm. Like I knew I had an older brother who just liked to hang out in the basement listening to Led Zeppelin, right? And was like, and but I didn't know until I had lent him all of my college money because he, you know, had told me a big story where, and my mom said, oh, we didn't want to tell you this, but your brother's been a heroin addict since the age of 12. Like I didn't know that. And he subsequently died of an overdose. Mm-hmm. My sister was a very severe alcoholic as a teen. And so, you know, my family was chaos and violence, and I sort of retreated into books and my imagination and swore I would never be like any of them, right? Like that was my thing. And I, you know, looking back now, it makes me sad that I, especially with my sister, that I was embarrassed as a teenager. Like I was embarrassed by her alcoholism, right? I was embarrassed that the police brought her home when she went out to a concert. I was embarrassed. And there was just no conversation around feelings or emotions or how's your day or what was going on. It was a very much like I was doing in this picture, pretend everything's okay. Like the house is burning, but just pretend it's a little warm, you know, and handle it. So I grew up very much relying on myself. I learned early on that I was safer alone. And I really like kind of carried that, you know, for decades, you know, and it's only been recently where I was like, oh, actually that, like, maybe I don't prefer to be alone. Like, you know, like this light bulb went off, like, actually, maybe that's just a story I told myself that doesn't serve me anymore. But yeah.
And I imagine almost this epiphany of that maybe it's okay to trust people, because I imagine that you probably felt quite unsafe in that environment and would have learned to not trust people as a child.
Right. Definitely. Yeah. And I think, you know, I tend to be weirdly trusting of people always, you know, like I really do believe that people are fundamentally good, and but I don't trust people with my like emotional, I don't trust people with my vulnerability, I don't trust people with my feelings, I think. I'll trust them like in my house probably randomly, but interpersonally that's much harder.
Yeah, it requires a level of vulnerability and a level of exposure. I totally understand what you mean there. I am very similar, actually. So, Lara, you grew up in an environment where addiction was rife and you had this exposure to it, and you decided as a child that you weren't going to drink or use drugs and that you were going to follow your own path. So where did things start to change, and how did you yourself fall into addiction?
So I was a late bloomer for addiction. I like to say I was a late bloomer and then like an overachiever, right? So, I tend to overachieve and like, I go big with whatever I do. So
yeah.
Not one felony, let's get 32, you know? I went off to college, you know, and I really thought I could sort of educate myself out of my family cycle. And I thought education meant inoculation in my mind, you know? And so I went 3,000 miles away from home. And in college, I did like a reasonable amount of partying, but nothing that turned into addiction. Although many of like our friend group did fall into that later, which is interesting to look back on. You know, we all had, I think, different set points. But it was really, I went straight to college and graduate school and got an MFA in creative writing. And then I had three children in 4.5 years, three boys.
Wow.
And I was in a marriage that, you know, I desperately wanted to have like, you might be too young to know like the Leave It to Beaver family, like that old sitcom, but I wanted to have this family I didn't have growing up. And so when that was not working out and there was infidelity in the marriage and I had tried everything, I remember, you know, taking an opiate that was prescribed to me, you know, they're prescribed after childbirth. And back then, you had an earache, you were in a mood that, you know, was handled at, Vicodin was handed out as sample packs in the US. And so I remember taking one of those pills and I think I was self-medicating for depression, but I never would have admitted I was depressed, you know, and it gave me what I call joy for no good reason, in spite of the circumstances around me. And the sneaky thing with that is that it took two to feel that joy for no good reason. And then I couldn't feel joy without it and just progressed and progressed. And, you know, at one point, which is hard to imagine because it would, you know, kill me now, but the nature of addiction and tolerance, at the end of that opiate pill addiction, I was taking 60 pain pills a day, 20 for breakfast, 20 for lunch, 20 for dinner, which is insane. Goodness. You know, to think about. And I knew, you know, I kept quitting over and over again. So I was like, I don't have a problem because I can keep quitting, right?
Yeah.
And I, you know, I had this mantra that I did in my head. And of course, again, never asking for help. But I had this mantra. Sorry, I made myself cry with my... So I had this mantra I did whenever I would quit in my head to kind of get through those first days or the week I would last before I would pick one up. I'd say, oh, see, I could do it. It's not a problem. I would go, choose life, like over and over in my head, because I knew, even though I wasn't really facing the addiction, I know it was not choosing life. You know, it was a very slow, inefficient way to kill yourself, right? And so it was just, I wanted to choose life and I didn't know how.
What were some of the signs of that depression that you didn't recognize at the time, but now in hindsight you can identify to be the case?
It's interesting because, you know, I had 3 boys in 4.5 years. So I don't know, like, I feel like some of it was probably postpartum and hormonal. And really it was just, you know, we were young and we were poor and struggling and it was really sort of like this, like, inability to have my spark, right? Like, I just didn't have a spark, I think is what it is, you know? And I couldn't find, normally I'm like a willpower person. Like, I'll will myself to do anything. I can get through anything. And I just couldn't find that spark. And I was really devastated at the ending of that family I wanted to create. I was really devastated. And I didn't have I didn't have the language of emotions. I didn't know how to tell people what was going on. And I was pretending. And to me, when I'm pretending everything's okay when it's not, or I'm pretending I love my job when I don't, or I'm not mad at my friend. When I'm pretending in any area of my life, to me, that is my warning sign now. That is my like relapse trigger, right? Like that is the thing. And it comes across as not being true to myself and pretending in any area.
Yeah, I totally get it. It's living behind a smile and it's being disconnected from your truth and your authenticity for whatever the reason is. And the more time that I spend disconnected from my truth, that irritability, that discomfort, all of that stuff starts to come up. And yeah, like, I'm not far away from a drink if I don't get on top of that really quickly.
Yeah. And I remember, like, I used to watch other people and be like, how are they just out for a bike ride and happy? Like, how do people do that? Like, it just sort of, you know, the disconnection from that spark in life. Like, how do people just go for a walk? Like, how are they just having conversations? Like, it was really like the world outside of my own head became a very foreign place to me.
Lara, you spoke about the tolerance that you started to build using those pain pills. Can you then describe to me, how did the shift occur from pain pills to heroin?
So, in my second marriage, I married someone I had met in recovery and who shared a similar addiction, and we were rebuilding our lives and bought a house and did, you know, had all of the trappings of, you know, I was a poster girl for recovery, right? And we had all of those trappings, and he had relapsed on heroin, and I found it in my house and I didn't know what it was. And I decided to try it. And it was something I swore I would never do because that's how my brother passed away. And so I tried it, and it's a very, you know, I started smoking. I had to Google how to smoke it, right? Like, I Googled it, and I was keeping it from him and still pretending like I was okay. And eventually he found out and we started doing it together. And, you know, it was only about 11 months before everything had blown up. We'd lost the house, lost all our money, lost our business.
Wow. Do you remember what went through your mind? Like, you've got many years of recovery under your belt at this time. Like, do you remember the mental twist that occurred when you thought all of a sudden, maybe this is a good idea?
You know what it was? It was similarly, I was very unhappy in my marriage. And I was like, oh, I've done it again. And I was pretending. And I was like, I have the minivan. I have the cul-de-sac. I have the 2-story house. Everything looks good. And I'm still not happy. What's wrong with me? And I think it was just, again, not talking, you know, I was sponsoring women, and I could tell others what to do in those circumstances. But in myself, like, I would never get really vulnerable with my sponsor or tell anyone what was really going on. So, you know, I wish there was like one little thing I could remember. It was just that I hadn't done the internal work. I had done all the external work. So when it was in front of me, you know, there was no safeguards to stop me from doing that, you know.
No defense. Yeah, no, I understand completely. And so you shared then that, you know, it was 11 months, not a long time at all, before everything really started to fall apart. And then you ended up having to do a lot of things that I'm sure you never would have imagined having had to do. And it's detailed beautifully in the book. Let's take it to November 4, 2008, the day that your life really did change forever. Can you describe what happened on this date?
So I was at home. My three older boys were all in school. They were in junior high and high school at the time. Caden, my youngest, who's in that picture, I had just set him in front of, you know, like the TV to watch his show Wonder Pets, which is a cartoon, you know, PBS show with all his stuffed animals. And the sheriffs came to the door, and there's a pounding on the door. And when anyone's pounding on the door, it's never a good thing, right? So they came in to arrest me and my husband at the time. And I knew in that moment, like, everything was over. And there was a part of me that was relieved because my son was home. They wouldn't let me call in. You know, I was begging to call someone to come take him. But they called Child Protective Services, and he was taken away by strangers. And that was really this sort of the breaking point for me. Like, I couldn't deny what I had done and the sort of collateral damage. And it was really probably the darkest moment of my life.
I remember reading that part in the book, and my heart just started to break for you. And you describe so well, the pain and the fear and the shame that was all coming up for you at this time. They took you to jail, and you were there with really no understanding of what had happened to your son, which I imagine just would have been gut-wrenching. And you talk about the fact that two nights later, you then planned to take your own life.
Yeah.
Can you tell me what happened there?
So in that, really what, like, really sort of the, I can only describe it as a blackness. You know, I had none of that spark. Even in, like, active, compulsive, messy addiction, you keep going every day. So even though, you know, there's still a little bit of spark of something, and it was just gone. And I decided that, that I had just failed at life. Like, I really believe that I imploded my life so thoroughly. The pain of not knowing where my son was, you know, I was imagining all sorts of horrible things were happening to him with strangers. I knew there was no way to get out of what was in front of me, and I didn't have it in me. I was like, I can't get through whatever this is coming, you know? And so I decided to end my life. I wrote a note to my boys telling them I love them and that I was sorry, and that I prayed addiction never got a hold of them. Yeah.
I'm so sorry. That just, it would have just been, like you said, so, so dark.
Yeah.
Thank goodness you are still here, because things did start to turn around eventually. And, you know, you've rebuilt your life to this point of absolute magnificence. Can you help me understand, in that moment when there's no more joy, and I imagine you had decided, you know, after you decided to stay, you were then with the intention of not using again, because you knew that you needed to get clean, to get through this process, to then get your children back. How hard was it to stay clean in jail?
It was so hard. There were more drugs in jail than I ever saw out in the real world. Yeah, it was really hard. It wasn't hard. It was hard to detox in jail. That is something I wouldn't wish on anyone. And I did it twice. And so, you know, it was easy the first 6 weeks, because sometimes it's easy in a crisis, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, and I was, you know, I started writing again, I started sleeping again, you know, I started feeling better. And then I did get out on bail. And, you know, that piece of the book, I have total strangers messaging me like, I was so furious at you. I'm so mad at you, you know, and because I, you know, I had, you know, a little bit of time clean. And then when I was out on bail, that all fell apart, you know, a couple months later. And so I think, you know, I didn't have that in the book originally, that time. I didn't have it in the book proposal when the book sold. But when I went to write the book, I'm like, I have to be really honest. And this is really the darkest part of my life and I wanted to be true to what addiction is, because it isn't like I just decided and everything was great, you know?
Yeah. I'm so grateful that you included that part in the book. In fact, I've got it written down. I've got notes. I've got it highlighted, because for me, this is just so true to addiction. And this is the reality of addiction, and that relapse is a big part of so many people's stories. And it's not something to feel shame about. It's something that you can get through. It doesn't mean it's the end of the road. Again, my heart really broke at this point, because you share in the book how you had always been smoking heroin, but on bail, you started to inject it. Mm-hmm. And it really seemed to me, when you were describing that part in the book where you were sitting in the car with your husband at the time, to me that you'd really lost the power of choice in that moment. Can you tell me more about what was going on in your mind at that time? Was it similar to the thoughts that you had in jail? Where were you at that point?
I was in this surreal place. You know, I just spent, you know, from all of November and December, you know, over 2 months in jail and limbo, not knowing, you know, what's going to happen. I got out of bail and it was just this sort of whirlwind. And my husband at the time had only smoked heroin and started injecting in jail in the men's side. And, you know, and he was like, here, you have to try it. And I could have said no, but I didn't have it in me to say no. I was just kind of going along. I wish I had better words as a writer to describe what that was, but it was so surreal. And I was really disoriented in terms of like, I'm out, but I probably am safer in, which is something my defense attorney had said. And I didn't understand what that meant. And then the difference between smoking and injecting was, you know, there was a huge difference. And I was still in this limbo place of, I don't know if I'm going to prison for 30 years. I don't know if I'm going to see my children again. And I let it swallow me up on bail, that sort of pain of not knowing. And I didn't have any tools at that point. Mm.
And so then you went back in and you had another experience of detoxing. Now, forgive me for my ignorance at this point, but I have to ask the question, Lara, can you help me understand what's the difference between jail and prison?
So one is run by state and one is run by counties. So basically there's in the U.S. system, there's federal prison run by the government. There's state prisons. And then there is jail run by individual counties. In California, and it varies county by county, in California where I live, you can be sentenced up to 3 years in jail. And because the prison's so overpopulated, a lot of women especially end up staying in jail. And it's a place that is not meant for long-term stays. It wasn't built for that. It doesn't have the programming, doesn't have the resources, especially for women. So that is the difference.
Mm. And what were some of the key takeaways? Like, what did you learn while you were in jail in terms of the conditions, what things took you by surprise? What do we need to change? Like, there's so much that you describe in the book, and we probably can't cover it all in one simple conversation, but what really struck you by surprise?
What struck me the most was a few things. One, the realization that we create family wherever we are, even in the worst circumstances, you know, the realization that incarceration was nothing like I had seen on TV or in the movies. You know, you get these extreme versions. The realization that when the entire world, I felt like the entire community, the world, my family, I was cut off from them. People were very angry at me. There wasn't a lot of compassion for me. These women I met in jail who were strangers saved me. You know, they saved me. And I also started writing again with them and ghostwriting in jail with them. And, you know, jail's a very, it's a barter system. You know, it's suspicious to do anything for free for anyone, you know, so that was like a whole new world to learn. And so I started writing letters as different women to help them. But 80% of the women in jail are mothers. That's what people don't know in jails. It's a little over 50% in prisons. So a lot of them were going through what I was going through with the separation with my son and Child Protective Services, and were helping me kind of learn the ropes. But the other thing that struck me was, you know, I would say it might not be exactly this, but it's very close to 100% of the women in jail have trauma. They have sexual assault, childhood abuse, some kind of violence. A lot of times the reasons women are in jail are interpersonal, around relationships and their drug dealer boyfriends. And the system in structure in jail is just so re-traumatizing and triggering, because it's controlled by men who control your access to the outside world, your whether you can get shampoo, whether you can have a phone call, when you sleep, when you eat, your freedom. And so it's really triggering and re-traumatizing for women.
Oh my goodness. Like, I really just, I can't imagine what it would be like. I think it's so beautiful how you describe this idea that you can make family wherever you are. And you talk so beautifully about taking on this role of mama love, which I don't think you intended to do going in there. I think it kind of took you by surprise from how you describe it in the book. But the relationships that you formed with those women was something that really struck me, particularly when the rest of the world had seemingly turned their back on you. And you experienced some pretty shaming things while you were in there, didn't you? Can you tell me about the time that the newspaper article was sent in?
Right. So at the time of my sentencing, and this was after I was out on bail and I had to go back, there was a newspaper reporter in there, a photographer, and they took my picture in the courtroom, even though I was trying to hide, you know, I was dodging and weaving. And it was on the front page of the paper, and it said, the Santa Cruz Sentinel, it said, Aptos neighbor from hell sentenced. And then it was a whole long article. Some of it was accurate. A lot of it was not. And, you know, I don't think, you know, public humiliation and shaming leads to rehabilitation at all. And, you know, I may have deserved that, but my kid, you know, my son in junior high, that paper was in every single classroom, you know, on the front page. So, as people can do online, there was all kinds of online comments, and someone anonymously printed those all out and mailed them to me in jail. And I read them over and over again. And some were people like in recovery. I could recognize the name, saying, oh, I used to go to meetings with her. You know, like some of the anonymity was not there. And so I built up a big resentment there for a while. But it was people just calling me every name in the book, and she'll get yours when she gets out. And so I read these things that sort of reinforced the worst things I was thinking about myself, and I internalized, and I like carried those, you know, it was hundreds of comments, not a lot to read in jail. And so I read them, but I carried those things around for years, you know, like figuratively over a decade and literally for a few years before I tossed them.
Yeah. You describe beautifully this idea of wearing shame like a heavy coat. Tell me, how have you managed to work towards freeing yourself from this shame over the past 14 years?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't something I was prepared for. You know, I really thought when I got out, like, I'm doing my time, I'm going to, you know, get work, I'm going to pay my restitution, and everything's going to be okay, we'll be done. And so, you know, the probation system and the barriers for reentry are a whole, you know, you could do a whole other show on that. but the stigma and the judgment and the shame, you know, I was desperately, you know, when I got out, I dyed my hair brown. You know, I used to sit in the back of meetings with my brown hair, and hopefully no one knew me. And I just was so afraid people would Google me and see that I was a neighbor from hell. And like, I'm actually a lovely neighbor, you know, now, but, you know, I was just hiding from everyone. And it's so, shame just multiplies when you're in isolation, right? And the stigma and the shame was something I carried for so long. Meanwhile, I have this job at a literary agency. I'm working with, you know, all these amazing people who are not judgy people. I was working with Archbishop Desmond Tutu and the Dalai Lama and Brian Stevenson. But I was hiding in the back of books and kind of, you know, trying to prove to myself and the world I was good through my work. And it was really only when I kind of owned the story for the first time and told some people, and it wasn't as big a deal as I had made it in my head, and people didn't run screaming from me, you know, and I got community again. And that's really what healed me, is just this little community and then a bigger community. And, you know, shedding that shame was just every layer of it just made me feel lighter and lighter of spirit and in every which way.
That's beautiful. Lara, have you ever been back to Aptos, to the cul-de-sac where you were arrested that day?
I have. Interestingly enough, I went back one time, you know, after, you know, this is just probably 2 years ago. I drove through, I didn't get out. I drove through with a friend of mine and I waited, you know, for like panic and that didn't come. And then I had to go back with the New York Times reporter. They did, New York Times did a profile piece before the book came out, and a photographer. And we went back to the neighborhood and I was able to, I was pretty neutral around it, you know, like I missed, I took for granted the life I had there, you know, and I wish I'd made different choices, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a lot of PTSD around seeing the house. And, you know, I had dreams for years and years and years weekly of that arrest moment and Caden being pulled from me, you know, and it was really only when I wrote the first draft of the book that those dreams almost stopped. They come now and then, like all moms have, but.
Wow. That must have been quite a profound moment, and almost that idea that the fear of a neighbor's going to come out and throw eggs or scream profanities, but it's, you know, time, I suppose, does time, heal. And that's huge. I'm really happy to hear that because I watched a TED talk of yours and I think at that time you hadn't been back. So I'm really happy to hear that you have now.
Yeah, I definitely did after that talk.
Yeah. Lara, can we go back a moment and can we talk about the challenges that women in particular face when leaving jail or prison and trying to get their life back on track? Because when you were describing this in the book, I was so frustrated for you. You describe how you had to get a job, you had to pay back restitution, you had to show up for random drug tests while you were meant to be at work. And if you didn't do the drug test, then you would go back to jail. But if you didn't show up for work or to your parole officer at any given time, you'd go back to jail. And I was just thinking, like, this system is stacked against you. What does that really look like? And how did that feel?
I mean, the best way I can describe it is that whole system is like walking on a high wire, you know, like a tightrope, a high wire in high heels in a windstorm every single day, right? Like that. And I, you know, I had no idea. And I think, you know, in the U.S., you know, I don't know what the stats are where you are, but in the U.S., one out of every three people have been arrested or they're under some kind of correctional control. One out of three.
Wow.
Right? And women, you know, like I said, 80% of women in jail are mothers, often the sole caregivers. And so when you get out and, you know, again, you think you're paying for your crimes, but you have to be in three different places at once. You have to have transportation. You know, like when I was in jail, we would have a goodbye party for a woman who was leaving. And then a week later, she would be rearrested and back in jail. And I used to think, that's so crazy. I'm never coming back here, right? Like, how could that happen? I didn't know until I got out how easy that can happen and how much like recidivism rates often have zero to do with committing another crime. It's the bureaucracy, it's three different courtrooms not coordinating with each other. It's having to be three places at once. It's people can, you know, there were times, and I'm coming from a place where I have a master's degree in education. I have the privilege of being a middle-class white woman. I had some family support a little bit, and it was still almost impossible not to go back to jail. And there were times in my life where I thought in those early years, I would be safer back in jail. When I actually wanted to be, because it was so disheartening and so impossible, and for simple reasons, you know, simple coordination could change that, and that's, you know, in my county, it varies county by county, state by state, case by case. So we're working to make that a little easier.
And it could be as simple as somebody making a phone call and making a false claim, can't it?
Yeah, when I was released, I was on this work release program. I got out 2 weeks early, but I had to go back and be at the outside doing landscaping in front of the jail. And the minute I got out, you know, we have a what's called a Vine system where people get notified if they've signed up to know when people are out. And so I don't know who it was. I can only guess, but someone called probation that morning and said I had violated my probation because I was seen driving by Caden's preschool. Well, first of all, I didn't have a car. I didn't know where Caden went to preschool. And I was in front of the jail on camera doing landscaping, but I had to go into court and defend myself. And so it was that easy to go back like wow. that, you know, but I was terrified. It's just like this constant terror that you're going to have to go back to jail, right? For years and years.
My goodness. And Lara, with the prison reform advocacy work that you do today, what are the main things that you're really focusing on to help change?
So I co-founded a nonprofit called the GEMMA Project, and we are three prongs. One is in-custody programming for women who are in jail or prison, because all the data shows that women respond to programming. And so we have a 10-week curriculum that we're going to be doing. And then reentry services to help them when they get out. Sometimes it's simple to arrange rides somewhere. You don't want to go back to jail because you don't have a ride to get to a drug test within 2 hours. So reentry services to help people find employment and meet all of those conditions that will land them back in jail if they don't meet them. And find childcare and the right clothes to wear to a job interview and helping people, you know, get work. And then policy advocacy and lobbying to change the laws, you know, because if you have to check a box that says, if you have to have a job as a condition of your probation or parole, but you have to check a box when you apply for a job that says you have a criminal background, you know, it's just this sort of loop-de-loop that people, it's impossible to traverse. And we, you know, that's why I say, like, we never sentence anyone to just a certain set of time. It's for a lifetime, you know, and the number one predictor of recidivism, of whether you'll go back to jail, is poverty. Right. And so women already make less money than men. If you've been incarcerated, I think it's like 67% less than that. And for women, especially, and with childcare. So yeah, there's a lot of work to do.
It sounds like it. And the work you are doing is just incredible. Not only that, you're a woman in recovery. I'd love to know, how did your recovery program work? Let's talk about the first couple of years. Mm-hmm. And then how has that evolved to what it looks like today?
Sure. You know, when I got out, you know, I believe, you know, there's a certain number of meetings you have to go to. And I remember, I'd left my, this is a funny story. I'd left my signature and I knew everyone in recovery. I was mostly just sort of embarrassed, which is, you know, not the place to be in recovery. You know, I could read the people that the general readers are curious about here. People will applaud in recovery. Like, you know, you're here and yeah, you did that crazy thing, which I loved the applause, right? Because nowhere else was anyone applauding me for anything. So that was my favorite part of early recovery. You get applauded. But I went to a lot of meetings. One time, you know, I left my meeting slip there and I like panicked. And so there I am the next day. I can't wait a week. I'm like breaking into this church, like climbing through a window, which, you know, definitely a violation of probation just to get my meeting slip. You know, like it was a crazy time, but it was.
And was that to give to your parole officer?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I had this woman who had sponsored me like my first time around in recovery, and she said, so I went to this meeting and I was really hiding from everyone. I had a little bit of resentment from the articles and just, you know, and I was embarrassed mostly, you know, and she said this one thing to me. It was a simple little thing. She said, "You're going to land on your feet. Don't worry." Like, it's just a simple little thing. But I remember latching onto that, right? Like, okay, she thinks this. She's got 20 something years in recovery. She knows me. She says I'm going to land on my feet. And, you know, I didn't know what that was going to look like. But what was great is when my book launch happened on August 1st, she was right in the front row.
Oh, wow.
You know, because it was just like, sometimes you just need even if you don't know how it's going to be okay, you need someone to tell you it's going to be okay. So you can at least look forward to looking back. So I went to a lot of meetings every day. That was my community. You know, people helped me. You know, when I had to eject someone from my house, the recovery people come over and packed them up, you know, things like that. It was really my foundation, and there's nothing else I could have done in my career, write these books, without that solid foundation of a lot of meetings.
It's such a beautiful story, and it really highlights the power of kindness and how just a few simple words, particularly if you're in recovery and there's, you know, people that are new walking through the rooms, the power of just a few kind words and how that can really change someone's life or become a beacon of hope for them to be guided by. And how is it, what does it now look like today? Because I'm imagining you're probably not going to a meeting every single day now.
I'm not going.
You are still clean and sober.
I'm still clean and sober. And I'm not going to a meeting every day. It'll be 15 years in March. I'm doing the math in this March. I go to all the parties, though, for sure. Like,
great.
Celebrate the recovery parties.
Love that.
I do that. I have a lot of good friends from recovery still, and so we're in touch. And I go to meetings when I need to. You know, and I, you know, it's just my way. I went, I had a woman I worked at the gym out at a gym with, and she was a nurse and she was keeping secret. She's in recovery, and she finally confessed to me. And so I started going with her and, you know, went to her 1 year celebration. And, so I'm there when people need me, and I go to meetings when I need them.
Yeah. That's beautiful. That's so beautiful. Lara, what does life look like today? And I guess what I mean by that is you've come so, so far. And I imagine a lot of the things that have happened, you probably could never have imagined happening when you were sitting in that jail cell back in 2008. I'd love to know, what does life look like today and what's next for you?
My life is amazing today. You know, I bought a house in 2019, and you know, since I left that house that I was arrested on, I hadn't owned a, you know, I hadn't had a home, and that felt really good. And it's a happy home. My youngest, like we said, just went off to college, and my older two boys just got engaged, and one just moved back to town with his fiance. So, you know, I'm getting ready for some weddings this year, maybe some babies coming our way.
Some grandbabies.
And I feel in a lot of ways, though, like in my career, you know, I worked as a ghostwriter writing other people's stories for a very long time. And then I did my own book. And that was a dream since I was a child. I am planning to write a novel, which is another thing. You know, I'm in my 50s and I'm like, what am I going to regret on my deathbed? Like, this is how, you know, it's a little morbid, but I think, like, what would I regret not doing? And so I'm making sure I'm doing those things. And I, you know, I worked so hard in early recovery and for the decade after to prove my worth and prove that I was good and valuable. I don't do that anymore. I don't feel the need to do that anymore. And so I get to bring books to the world as a literary agent, other people's stories, you know, and champion them and shine a light on different voices. And I love that. And I feel like I'm just getting started. You know, they're also making a TV series out of the book.
Oh, my goodness. That's amazing. I can't wait.
It's going to be a dark comedy. And so, you know, I'm going to get into the world of Hollywood and maybe do some writing. Like, I really do feel in many ways I'm just getting started as me. And so my practice every day is to be present for all of it, right? To really be present. Because even in recovery, sometimes I wasn't present for the good things because I was working so hard to get the good things, right? Or to prove that I was good. And so now I just try, you know, I sleep, I prioritize self-care. You know, I will take the day off if I'm not feeling it. And that's something new for me. So now I just, every day I see what unfolds. And, you know, I started my own company last year. And so, you know, I'm just getting started. And it's never too late, right?
That That it's inspiring. It really, really is. And I hope everybody listening along today feels inspired by your story as well. Lara, there's one final question, and I feel like it's a great segue from what you were just sharing there around self-care and learning to slow down. But my final question for you is, what are your three non-negotiables that allow you to live your life today happy, joyous, and free?
That is such a good question. Community and relationships, deep ones, not surface level. So deep friendships, deep relationships. And this is going to sound contrary to that, but autonomy. And freedom in every area of my life.
Beautiful. I love that. Thank you for sharing.
That's just off the top of my head. Yeah.
Yeah, they're perfect. They're perfect. Really, really great. Lara, if people want to read the book, track you down, find out more about you, where should they go?
So probably Instagram first, which, is new since the book launch. My 18-year-old is like, Mom, stay off of social media, but nope. everything I do is cringe, according to him. But yeah, Instagram at Lara Love Harden, and it's spelled L-A-R-A, Lara Love Harden. If you want to learn more about the nonprofit, thegemmaproject.org.
Excellent. Thank you. I'll make sure I pop all of that information in the episode show notes. Lara, wonderful. We say here on Behind the Smile that when we recover loudly, no one needs suffer in silence. So thank you so, so much for gifting the world this incredible book, The Many Lives of Mama Love, and for all of the amazing work that you do. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
A big thank you for tuning in today. If you'd like to support the show, you can do so by hitting the follow button and leaving a rating and review. Each rating and review helps this podcast become more discoverable so more people can hear these stories of strength and hope. Together, we will continue to remove the stigma around mental health, trauma, and addiction. Remember to reach out to those you care about, and I'll be back next week. Until then.